The Tom Woods Show, episode 90210.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Today's episode is sponsored by Harry's Razors. To get your free trial set, including a razor handle, five-blade cartridge, and shave gel, go to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. Hey, everybody, it's Michael Malice. Tom decided to take a break for one day, a well-deserved break, after giving you new episodes of his show 7 days a week for almost a couple years now. So it's been a big privilege of mine to fill in and be the first ever guest host on The Tom Woods Show. And I have a very special guest for you all today. By now, you all know Tom Woods. He is a senior fellow of the Mises Foundation and host of the Tom Woods series. He holds a bachelor's degree from Harvard and has a master's and a PhD from Columbus University. Tom has written a baker's dozen of books, most recently, How to Really Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to Index Cards of What is Allowable, as well as Rolling Back Big Government and The Nullification of Tyranny. Tom, welcome to the show.
You're such a jerk. Thanks so much for having me, Michael. Always a pleasure. I appreciate you filling in, by the way. It gives me some time off.
My pleasure. So, Tom, let's get into it. What made you decide to launch your own podcast, and what were your big fears before doing so?
Okay. Well, part of the reason I decided to do it was that I was doing a terrible, terrible project that if I mentioned it to my listeners one more time, they are actually going to do me bodily harm.
Is it a free ebook?
It is not a free ebook. That is an easy project. No, when I was working on the Ron Paul curriculum stuff, I thought I'm going to be buried and no one's going to hear from me because I'm not going to be producing anything that's going to be immediately consumable. So I thought if I could produce something every day or every weekday that's 30 minutes long, then I'm still kind of out there. People still remember who I am, and I can still be saying, I did this today. So that was part of the reason. But the other thing was, when I was filling in on the Peter Schiff show, which was a full-blown radio show, I would get people saying, well, you should have your own show. You should be a spinoff of the Peter Schiff show. And I kind of thought, yeah, maybe. And I just had so many people saying that, and I thought, you know, I don't know exactly how this is going to benefit me, but in some way, I feel like it's going to. And plus, I know I would enjoy talking to people every day, so I might as well do that. The fear, the only real fear was, and by the way, I'm still wearing headphones from when I was testing the audio before, because this is new equipment we're using. So I'm going to take these off because I look like an idiot. You're not wearing, listen to this. Now it's all different, talking all of a sudden. Anyway, the main fear was, could I keep it up? I mean, 5 episodes a week is a big commitment. What if I couldn't think of enough things to talk about, or there weren't enough guests, or it just got overwhelming? And actually, that hasn't been so bad.
Why did you decide then not to launch with, like, let's say 3 times a week?
I thought if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be like a hardcore content producer. I'm just going to do it. And plus, I felt like if the show is, well, I imagine it this way. I imagine it being a commute length show.
Okay.
So people have 5 commutes a week. I want to give you 5 shows a week.
What were some of the biggest mistakes you did when you were first? Because I'm sure a lot of it's trial by fire, right? So what were some of the things that you wish you could have gone back in time and told yourself, don't do this or don't do that?
Yeah. First of all, don't try to make it live. What is the point of that? The whole value of a podcast is that it's recorded and consumable on demand. But for some reason, because I was still stuck in radio mode because of the Peter Schiff show, I thought it should be live. I should be taking calls. And I thought, no, like whenever I listen to a show, I hate when they take calls. I just want to hear the host or the host and the guest. So that was a mistake. Then secondly, I didn't get the audio right for a long time, and I knew it was, and I knew there were problems with it, but I was so busy, I just couldn't even take the time. And we were living kind of in the middle of nowhere at the time. Where am I going to find an audio expert?
Right.
You know, whereas here in Orlando, the Orlando area, the Podcast Factory is right in Orlando, and I actually intend to go over there and talk to them at one point. So it'd be a lot easier to fix now. But I was just so busy. Whereas when you were on with Thaddeus Russell recently, his audio sounded great from episode one. Of course, you were on episode one. Perfect, great, just the way it should sound. Excellent. I wish I had done that. I wish I'd had more time to do that. But other than that, I think it's been pretty good.
Well, it's all downhill from there for Thaddeus, so.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, once he has Malice on, right, what's he going to do, have Woods? I mean, come on.
So you've interviewed a lot of people. Some you agree with almost entirely. Some you disagree with on a lot of things. How has your thinking changed the most since launching the show?
Well, that's a good question.
Thank you.
You know, once in a while, you come up with a good one. I'll hand you that. There has been a kind of a change in my outlook as to who in the country irritates me the most. Initially, I was all about attacking the neocons, and it was just always attacking the neocons. Very rarely would I put out an episode critical of Barack Obama. Almost never. I mean, Obamacare, okay. Almost, you know, perfunctory references to that. I had to do that. But I found that so boring. I thought, the problems with Obama are so obvious. Everybody gets that already. I don't want to do things that are obvious. It's not obvious, the problems with people who use conservative rhetoric and they talk about limited government and they're terrible on everything. That's not obvious. And a lot of people are being suckered into that and they're sending, you know, old ladies are sending their Social Security checks into the Heritage Foundation. And this is just terrible. I can't let this go on. So I attack them quite a bit. But now, for a variety of reasons, just because of the way the cultural winds have shifted over the past few years, the left is so obnoxious now that I wouldn't say I've let the neocons off the hook, but my attention has turned more to the left and their antics in the streets and on the universities and their penchant for violence and their double standards and what a bunch of hypocrites they are. I just can't stop talking about it. So that's definitely a way that the show has changed. I mean, you can see a clear drift in that direction. And, you know, at some point I'll drift off in some other direction, but it's not called the Libertarian News Hour. It's called the Tom Woods Show. And so it's, you know, it's going to be a little quirky and idiosyncratic.
So do you, when people do podcasts, the stereotypical podcaster is someone who's like, you know, not trapped at home, but like is like a prime mover. Would you consider yourself to be more of an introvert or an extrovert?
Man, that's a good one too. Yeah, two in a row. How about that? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's possible to say that you're both, because there's a part of me that really relishes the spotlight, you know, and everybody, I presume, enjoys going out, being introduced and having a big crowd reaction. And then afterward, I love talking to people.
No, that's what makes an extrovert.
Okay.
I'm not joking.
Okay. But see, the funny thing is, but here's the other side of it though. We were at an event. It was the Mises Institute had a special birthday party celebration for Ron Paul's 80th birthday.
Who is Ron Paul?
Yeah.
Ron Paul. Yeah. Everyone Google Ron Paul.
Yeah, Google Ron Paul, in case you don't know. He's been a guest of the Tom Woods Show.
That's, second favorite guest.
That's in his list. That's right. That's right. When we did a poll, that's right. I forget who the first one was. Bob Murphy, maybe?
Who?
I forget. So we went to this. I took two of my kids to the 80th birthday party for Ron Paul. And there was a big lunch thing, buffet-style lunch. And as we were waiting in line to get our food, I had so many people coming up to me and saying, thank you for this and thank you for that, and I read this book or I listened to this thing you did or this changed my life. And I mean, these are amazing things. I mean, I have a terrific life in that sense that I get to get this sort of feedback. You know, it's not all positive all the time, but in that setting it is. And that's a really rewarding and a wonderful thing. But at the same time, my eldest daughter, Regina, asked me, Dad, do you like that when people come up and tell you things like that? And I said, yeah, you know, I do. And in theory, I really do. But right now, I think what I would like most is just to have lunch with you and your sister.
Aw.
You know, I mean, more than, there was a time in my life when it was really not a healthy situation. I mean, I all of a sudden, out of the blue in 2009, I was attracting all this attention and people wanting autographs and pictures and treating me like a celebrity. And then it got unhealthy. Like I started craving it. Like I needed big crowds and I needed all this response. And now I feel like it's a good thing, like in my maturity, that I've gotten to a point where I say, that's wonderful. And it's just very rewarding to get all this feedback. But when all's said and done, there's nothing I would like more than to just sit down with my own family and just have a nice chat.
So I've gotten somewhat similar reactions, and I've had it from the other perspective, which is, you know, they always have that saying, never meet your heroes, that you meet someone because you don't, aren't a fan of the actual person. You're a fan of what that person represents to you. And you often build up this facade of that person in your mind. And when you meet an actual human being, of course, they're going to fall short a little bit of this idealized version of what you're projecting. Like Barack Obama won on that. You know, everyone read into him that he's this version of what their best selves. And he's just, you know, some typical progressive in many senses. So the question I have for you is, what do you think fans of yours and people who idealize you would be most disappointed to know if they met you?
We have a spectator who's smiling at that question.
A spectator is haunting Tom's Woods' house. That's right. The specter of Heather.
Yeah. All right. Well, first of all, my height. Let's start with the mundane.
Okay.
I get a lot of people saying, you're a lot shorter than I thought you'd be.
I've never heard that myself, so sorry for you.
I've actually had that numerous times. What kind of a thing is that to say? What am I, back in the seventh grade? What is this?
Well, height-wise.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it would be disappointing, but I don't... It's just weird. Like, people... For example, I was driving along a few months ago. I was driving along, and right in front of me, the car in front of me had a bumper sticker. It was the Freedom bumper sticker that Adam Kokesh produces. So I thought, there's a decent chance this guy knows who I am if he knows Kokesh. So I happened to pull alongside him, rolled my window down. I said, hey, you know, I saw your bumper sticker. And so at a light, we started talking. And he said, wait a minute, you're Tom Woods. And I said, hey, isn't this great? Whatever. And I said, you know, look, write to me at my website and we'll get together. Because I didn't know anybody in Florida at that time. And the guy posted about it on Facebook like it was the most amazing experience ever. And I think when you realize how mundane my other interests are and how square and bourgeois my lifestyle is, it might be a bit of a letdown for some people. I'm not always slaying, you know, evil malefactors all day long.
Let's talk about how mundane and bourgeois you are, Tom, because when we were out to dinner, you referenced a meme without even realizing you're referencing it. You were talking about your crappy taste in music and mentioning all these bands you like. And then you said the phrase, you probably hadn't heard of them. Now that is the textbook hipster expression. So tell me about some of these terrible bands that you like, these prog bands. I really want to hear about them.
Sorry.
Are you allergic to tough questions? And then we'll take a break for us.
I was going to say, maybe we should keep that in then. That was good.
Yeah.
All right. So you want to know about my bands. All right, look, I'll take a few minutes to answer this. And
oh,
then
God.
On the show notes page, which will be tomwoods.com/902.
Let me do my job, which will be available at tomwoods.com/902.
Right. Thank you so much.
My welcome.
I'll even put a list of things that you should all listen to. And you'll come back to me and say, Woods, my life is better and richer because I listen to this stuff. And thank you.
Okay.
Right? So here, I'll give you three bands from yesteryear. And three from today.
Okay.
How about that? From yesteryear, I mean, they're still around, but they're like 107, all the band members. So I could say yesteryear. First one is Jethro Tull, headed by Ian Anderson, who was guest on episode 3 of The Tom Woods Show.
Oh, wow.
So I bet
that must have been a thrill.
Oh, you kidding me? But I was like a little fanboy, and it was the third episode. I still don't quite know what I'm doing.
Right.
And I'm having like the guy I've wanted to talk to my whole life is now guest on episode 3. Okay. But I mean, he was fine. It was an interesting conversation, but I'd gotten to meet him backstage. It's a long story, but... So I got pictures. I mean, it was fun. So I got to have him on the show. But what I love about all these bands, including Jethro Tull, is that it's not like, it's like, I don't want to insult people who are AC/DC fans, but once you have one AC/DC album, you pretty much have them all. But that's not true with Jethro Tull. Each one is distinct. Each one is, it's almost like it's a whole different band. And it amazes me that you could have a band that produces two albums in a row, each of which is one song. The entire album is a 45-minute song, and each one hit number one in the U.S. Now, something happened to the American attention span, because that would never happen today.
Yeah, what happened was punk.
Yeah.
And there's even a band, I forget what they're called, but they have a song called A 3-Minute Song Is 1 Minute Too Long.
Yeah,
Even
there
As
you
We
go.
Speak, the band's called Even As We Speak. They're Australian, and they're excellent, and you probably haven't heard of them.
Oh, ho! All right, so anyway, what I love about it is Ian Anderson plays the flute, and he somehow makes this work in rock music. I love him. He's an amazing musician, plays many instruments. He's amazing and brilliant, and that's great. Second one, I guess, would be, I'll go faster, is Yes, because they write such, I mean, okay, they've written some music that you have to be a really hardcore fan.
Aren't they still around? They've been around forever.
They are. They were just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And yeah, they are still around. In fact, I'm going to be going to see them a couple of times this year. I'm super excited about that. But John Anderson, who is now 72, still sings with this angelic voice. And his vocals are beautiful. Their arrangements are beautiful. They're daring. They take risks in their music. But I mean, it's like, I feel like the world is a better place. My life is happier. My life is enriched because their music exists. And that's more than you can say for, I mean, look, Billy Joel writes, I know you don't like Billy Joel, but he's an example of what I mean. If you like 3-minute songs with catchy melodies, he's good at that. He can come up with a catchy melody for a 3-minute song. But I wouldn't say my life is enriched because of that. But my life is enriched because the song Turn of the Century exists, or the song Awaken exists. That makes my life better and happier. So, in fact, I'll just give you those two. Then for these days, most of the things I like are not that well known. But one of them is a band called Porcupine Tree. They are great. They are great. You get anything by them, anything, let's say, post-1997, and it's excellent. And they sort of are no longer in existence, but their leader, Steven Wilson, has a solo career that's kind of eclectic, but he has this fantastic album called Hand Cannot Erase, and it's loosely based on the true story of Joyce Carol Vincent, a woman in the UK, who moved to London, and then she died, and nobody knew she was dead for 2 years.
Oh, my God.
No one discovered it. Like, no one... She just, and you think, well, gee, that's a paradox. There she is in the middle of all these people in the big city, and nobody, but his argument was that it's precisely the anonymity of the big city that allows you to go and get lost there. And so he explored this about how this woman, little by little, retreated from the world until finally there was no more. I mean, it's stunning. So I like stuff like that. It's not
cerebral.
I mean, yeah, it's cerebral, and yet a lot of it is very simple melodies sometimes, but it moves you. Like, I want to be moved. I don't want to just tap my foot. I want to be moved. That moves me.
Okay. Well, you were friendly with Murray Rothbard, but I know you never met Ayn Rand. If you got to meet Ayn Rand, what would you ask her?
I guess I would ask her, what is the flaw you see in Thomas Aquinas's demonstrations of the existence of God? Okay. I know you respect Aquinas, so what are the precise flaws in the arguments?
Do you know the actual quote about her and Aquinas where she was yelling at Leonard Peikoff?
What did she say?
Someone was condemning religion and priests or something, and she's just like, but what about Thomas Aquinas?
All right, well, I knew that she had respect for him.
Oh, enormous. Yeah. She said the three A's were Aristotle, Aquinas, and Ayn Rand.
Well, all right then.
Yeah, so that's I mean, that's as high as it gets in her estimation.
Sure.
So, but I think the flaws in Aquinas' argument are pretty well established.
The conventional wisdom, I think, is that these were all debunked. But then when you revisit the alleged debunkings, they're not really that good, I don't think. I think they actually do stand up pretty well, particularly the one that I covered on, I think it might be episode 271. Now, wouldn't that be kind of sick if that really was the correct episode number?
No, because I used to know the issue number of every appearance of the Legion of Superheroes and what happened.
Oh, that's much worse.
Adventure Comics 300 to 380.
Well, it's somewhere in the 270s, but I did an episode where I walked through a kind of a modern rendition of one
is that the one you said, arguments. No, you're not a dummy for believing in God?
Yes, that one.
Yeah. I think I was on the episode either before it or after it.
Oh, okay. That must have been one of the first ones that it'd be interesting to go back and listen to that one when I didn't know you yet.
Right.
And to hear how we interacted in those days.
Well, the first appearance was about my book, Dear Reader, right. And about North Korea, which a book which you still haven't finished, even though I've read all 14 of your books.
You're such a...
Including two you haven't even written yet. So I guess some friendships are more one-sided than others. But I don't know.
And how many children do you have, Michael? Could you just refresh my memory?
Six. I don't know where they are, but I fathered six.
Have you?
What has been the episode that has gotten the biggest reaction?
Uh-huh. Well, okay, there's a class of episodes that got a big reaction, which was when Lou Rockwell and I would review the Republican debates.
Okay.
Everybody would tell me, I don't care about politics. I'm a libertarian who cares more about blah, 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 blah. But you know what, you liar? You downloaded the episode and you listened to it because I have the records. So
I have the documents.
Yeah, that's right. So there was definitely that. Some of the debate episodes have generated some interesting feedback. We had a debate on Zionism and libertarianism, and it goes to show that we can actually have civil conversations about controversial subjects. So that was good. I mean, I know as soon as we get off here, I'll think, oh no, that was the one. That was the big controversial one. But of course, when I have well-known people on, those episodes take on lives of their own. So I had the wrestler Kane from the WWE on, and that just blew up in terms of download figures because it actually leaked into the wrestling world. There were wrestling magazines that linked to that episode, and they were, I'm not kidding, they were writing articles saying, basically, gee, we didn't realize Kane is actually kind of smart. You know? So, okay. So now he's running for office. Did you know that? He's running for mayor of, it's odd that it's mayor of Knox County, Tennessee.
Okay.
And he's actually running for office there. But so, yeah, that stuff. But it's funny, I've gone through the download figures, and it's not like there's one that's just super duper way, way outperforming all the others.
Well, what about in terms of like comments and response in that sense?
Yeah, well, I'm sure that Zionism one. Then also, I did one on the basic income guarantee, which has become fashionable even among some libertarians.
We're going to use air quotes for libertarians for that one.
Well, yeah, for that one, indeed. So I had somebody on to talk about that, and we had a bit of a back and forth on it. And some people were saying to me, Woods, you should have torn his head off, and you were much too polite. And so I couldn't listen. I had to turn it off. So how about that? I'm too polite. They have to turn it off. It's not I'm too much of a jerk. They have to turn it off. And I said, well, if you turned it off, then you missed everything I was working toward, which was I was super nice and polite. And so by the end, I got him to concede three things. Number one, the logic of his position requires global redistribution from the U.S. to less wealthy countries. Secondly, this will mean a dramatic decrease in the American standard of living. And thirdly, we will probably need some form of global governance to carry this out. Now, if I got those three concessions out of the guy, I think the episode was worth it.
Speaking of being too nice, let's take a moment and thank our sponsors. Folks, for the holidays, Tom got me Harry's razor set. I use it all the time. It looks very fancy and very expensive, but it's not. And that's what I enjoy about it. Harry's is so confident you will love their blades, they're giving you their trial set for free. All you got to do is cover $3 shipping. You get a weighted ergonomic razor handle. You get 5 precision engineers blade with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade. You get rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. So stop messing around and get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer, a $13 value for free. Just cover shipping. To get your free trial set, including the razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shave gel, go to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. Okay, so what I want to know is, when you are interviewing someone who you haven't had on the show before, I'm sure sometimes within 3 to 5 minutes, you realize, oh my gosh, this person's a dud.
Yes. What? That has happened, and I'm not telling you what episode numbers they are.
I'm not asking who. What I'm saying is, what is your thought process at that point, and how do you work around it? Because you haven't ever like not released an episode, have you?
Let's see. Now, there was a time that I did a debate episode, and one of the two parties just made it very difficult for me to release it.
Oh, was that the one where we debated Hamilton, but I won, so you didn't
want to
release it?
Oh, yeah, in the alternate universe, yeah. But let's see. You know, then there was one where I had a guest.
Wait. You didn't release the debate episode because they made it difficult?
It's hard. I can't.
You can't get into it. Okay.
I'll tell you privately after it's over.
Well, don't tease the audience like that.
Look. If you wind up being as good a guest as Michael Malice, that you get voted the best guest ever, I'll come tell you the story of that episode too.
You hear that, Ron Paul?
Yeah, I'm not telling him till he moves up in the rankings.
Sorry, sucker.
Yeah. But then, no, there actually was an episode where I, for the life of me, could not follow the guy's argument. Could not follow it, no matter what I asked, no matter what prodding I did. And I just finally said, thanks for being on the show. And then, there's nothing I could do. And then also there was an African economist I liked very much, but audio quality was so bad, and he had such a heavy accent that you could deal with one or the other, but the two together, no one would have understood anything he was saying. And he was too old for me to say, well, can you use Skype or can you? There was no way to improve it.
Right.
So that's okay. I mean, most of them have aired. I can happily say most have aired. On the other hand, if they hadn't aired, man, think of what a giveaway that would be. I could give, you know, to my top supporters, right? The cutting room floor tapes of the Tom Woods Show.
Here's a question about Tom Woods, the family man. You have five daughters, okay? And one day they'll be able to listen back to these shows and listen to Dad at his prime. What is your favorite thing about each of your kids?
Oh, that's a great... Yeah, I didn't see that question going in that direction. I thought I thought it was going to be like, what am I going to be embarrassed about when they listen to me? But
oh, that's obvious.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let's see. All right, favorite thing about each
one. In order.
Yeah, in order. All right, so we'll start with the littlest.
Start with Regina, the first.
Okay, so Regina came first. Yeah, Regina, as you and I speak, is next month turning 14. And it's hard to narrow this one down, but because she's really smart and she's interested in a lot of the same things that I am, and she has excellent musical taste, which means she listens to what I like.
Poor girl.
But yeah, I know. But her life is deeply enriched by that, you jerk.
Value is subjective, but your taste is terrible.
Oh, you haven't even... Look.
I have listened to your crappy music. Pardon
my
French.
No, look. We're gonna deal with this another time.
And you listened to my music and you enjoyed it. So here we are.
Because I'm honest.
And I'm honest too.
No.
You're honestly terrible.
No. Right. Anyway, let me get back to this. What I love about... If I had to just pick one thing about Regina, is she's incredibly thoughtful and kind. Like, she's the one who, when there's that one kid who's being tortured and terrorized by the other kids, she's the one who goes and befriends that kid. She's the one who feels injustice intensely. It overwhelms her that there's injustice in the world. I mean, not abstract injustice around the world, but injustices that she sees, she wants to know how she can fix. She, at one of her birthdays, for example, she's very interested in and solicitous of animal welfare. So one of her birthdays, she said, I don't want any gifts. I'd like you to take the money you would have spent and donate it to the local animal shelter.
That's very nice.
And that's what we did. So she didn't get a gift, but that to her was a gift. And so that's why she herself, she is a gift to me.
That's lovely.
Yeah. So
now you got a tough act to follow with the other four.
Yeah, I know. That's true. So let's see. With Veronica, first of all, she has a deadpan, almost Bob Newhart style sense of humor that sometimes just cracks me up. And I love the smile on her face because it's hard to get me to laugh spontaneously. I mean, you do it effortlessly, so it seems like it's easy, but most people have a hard time doing it. So when she does it, she feels like it's a real sense of accomplishment. I made him spontaneously do a non-polite laugh, just a laugh. But also, she's extremely responsible. She's the one who, you know, that without being asked, she'll say, you know, this room really should be straightened up. I think I'll do it. It would make everybody happy if this room were straightened up. So not only will I do it, but I'm the most efficient one at it. And that's true. Wow. So I say, whoa, how did this happen? Oh, I cleaned it up while you were in the kitchen.
Wow.
Oh, great. Thanks. All right. So now I get to Amy. Amy's the middle one.
Who looks like you.
Yeah.
It's
uncanny.
It's weird to see a girl, Tom, and she's cute.
Yeah, I know. How did she pull
that? No, because
that
you think
out?
Tom with the wig is gonna, but she's adorable looking.
Yeah, so I don't get that either. It's a weird thing. But Amy is extremely funny and clever. Like, she loves to solve puzzles the way I do. So she likes doing escape rooms basically more than any of the other kids. And like, we count down the days. We're dying to go do these things. So she just takes such pleasure in playing together. She wants to play games. She likes to, like, one of the things that gives her the most pleasure is there's a series of games for her Nintendo 3DS that pretty much involves doing brain teasing math style puzzles, and she's in her glory sitting there doing those. And I just think, wow, that's me. that's great. That's tremendous. She doesn't like my music at all, but I overlooked that because of her other good qualities.
She's a smart kid, huh?
Yeah. All right, so Elizabeth now is 7. And I don't know what to say about her.
She's a sweetheart.
That really is it.
She is. She lights up every room.
That is it. That is it. She is, I mean, you know, nobody, myself included, is perfect and in great spirits all the time, but she comes as close as you can reasonably expect. She is just full of joy. And so being able to take her places and do things with her and spend time, even just playing Go Fish with her or something, it just brings her such delight and such big smiles that I just, I'm looking forward over this summer to having a little trip I'm going to take just with the two youngest ones, 7 and 3. And we're going to do all kid sorts of things, you know, where they don't have to watch grown-up movies or do grown, that we're just going to do all kid things for a few days, and it'll be fun. So that brings me to the 3-year-old, Sarah. She's unbelievably cute, and she's unfailingly polite. No thank you, and may I please have such and such, and eager to please. And again, when you do something with her, you take her somewhere, she takes like outsized, disproportionate delight in it. And she lights up the room too. Now she can be difficult, and she's hard to get to sleep at night. So, you know, she is still 3 years old after all. But man, I can see this little kid is going to be, you know, another outstanding Woods. And I can't wait to continue, you know, just to see her continue to blossom.
Now, I'm not going to ask you which of your kids is your favorite, because I do believe parents when they say all their kids are their favorite, because you like them in different ways, right?
That's right.
Which of your books is your least favorite?
Oh.
Because I'm sure there's, you have them ranked. There's no way you don't have, when you have 12, there's some that mean more to you than others.
This is kind of a tricky one. All right. I think I've got it. But in terms of, not that the book stinks, but that the experience I associate with it is just so negative. And I'd like to give two answers, and I'll rank them. So the first one would be Meltdown, which was the book on the financial crisis. And I had to write that fast because, you know, chances are a lot of people are going to write a book on a major financial crisis. And I didn't have as big of a name as those people did. So the only way I could get any notoriety for the book was to be the first one. So that meant working very intensely, because I didn't even think of the idea till I think maybe September of, or maybe August of 2008. So, I mean, it was, you know, and then the book was in the stores in early February, first week of February, in the stores.
Wow.
Which, I mean, Regnery turned it around. And when you consider that publishing shuts down for a couple weeks around Christmas time, it's even more remarkable. But it took a tremendous toll on me physically to work that quickly. It took a tremendous toll on the family and on important relationships. I sacrificed just everything to get this thing out there. And, you know, with this sort of melodramatic view that I'm doing work that's so important. Oh, I'm so tired of all this self-important stuff about, you know, I mean, it is important what we're all doing as libertarians, but geez, you know, you have a hierarchy of responsibilities, and saving the world is a little bit below, you know, maintaining your own household.
You sound like a Randian.
But I mean, it's noble to save the world, but you got to get everything else in. You got to get your priorities right.
Sometimes you got to shrug.
And then secondly, right, exactly. And then secondly would have been Rollback, which has some of my best material in it. I mean, these are really good arguments against the state on all levels. And it came out in 2011. That one was as hard and as intense as a Meltdown, because I had so much material I wanted to master. I wanted to give people ammunition on all kinds of things. So I worked incredibly hard on it, but it got to the point where I was having physical manifestations of stress and anxiety, so that my heart rate was elevated. Like, I could actually feel my heart beating in my chest. And I remember I would just go out and say, I got to get some air. I was short of breath sometimes, even though I wasn't like I had gone up a flight of stairs or anything. I was just suddenly short of breath. And I remember I had a pain in my foot, and I actually thought I had done something to it. And I went to the doctor, and there's nothing wrong. There's no fracture. There's no break. There's no nothing. And I just walked around, and I remember in 2011 at CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, I walked around limping with this foot injury that turned out not to be an injury. It was some psychosomatic thing, because as soon as I finished, the day I finished Rollback, it went away.
Oh, wow.
It is absolutely bizarre. And at that point, I said, I don't think I want to write any more books.
Was that the last one?
It wasn't, actually, because I did Real Descent in 2014, but that was just, you know, those were just essays I'd already written. So that was easy. I just put it together.
That was the last one, yeah.
So the last one with original material was 2011, because I just thought, I think I've done what I can do in that medium, and it's not helping me. It's really, really taken a toll. It's hard work, and I'm balancing too many things. And so I think some people probably didn't even believe me when I said, because how many times in the past have I said, well, now this is going to be it. I won't. But it really was. That was it.
Last question I have for you is, there's a lot of infighting in libertarianism. What is your personal definition for someone who is not really a libertarian? At what point are you ready to read them out of the movement?
Oh, okay. I wonder about this, because there is a part of me that kind of says, I don't know, that's not true. I was going to say, I kind of am inclined to let people define for themselves what they are, but
lies.
Kind of a terrible answer is
lies.
That. That's no kind of answer at all.
You're on a lie detector and you blew it up.
Yeah. What would you have to do for me to say you're not a libertarian? I mean, I see so many people throwing around you're not a libertarian for really dumb reasons, for reasons that have nothing to do with libertarianism. Like, if you don't celebrate sexual freedom, then you're not a libertarian. What does that have to do with anything?
What does that voice have to do with anything? What was that?
I always do that when I'm contemptuous of something.
Yes.
I do the effeminate voice.
Okay, that sounds like a cartoon or something.
Yeah, no, I do that effeminate voice sometimes. I forget the last time I did it, but it really stings, I hope.
Nope.
But I mean,
it's,
you know,
just confusing.
Like, what possible difference would it make what somebody's opinion on stuff like that was when the issue is non-aggression?
Right. That's not a.
So lifestyle choices have nothing whatsoever to do with it, or whether you're a square or not a square, it has nothing to do with it. So it's definitely not that. But I mean, look, what is libertarianism? It's I believe it's the non-aggression principle. That's what it is, first and foremost. So what would somebody have to do for me to think they're not a libertarian? I mean, am I saying that a minarchist is not a libertarian?
Are you?
I just don't think I can.
And yeah, yet, I don't think you can either.
But isn't that a contradiction? Because some minarchists are violating.
Well, it could be that you're saying anyone who consciously repudiates the NAP is not
you
a
are helping me
because
refine
a lot of these minarchists don't believe they're violating the NAP, really.
Right, and I wouldn't say, what am I going to say, Ron Paul's not a libertarian? That's just stupid.
Right.
You know? That's
who?
So, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I don't want to have some definition that only 12 people would conform to. Yeah.
Now you're sounding even more like Rand.
So, I mean, for me, I kind of feel like, I don't know, because foreign policy is so important to me and war is so important to me that if you're supporting a war that is clearly, and I mean, to me, that is based on propaganda that the rest of the world clearly sees, it's only Americans who don't see, and you are just repeating the regime's arguments. But
you're a dupe. That doesn't mean you're not a libertarian. You could be a dupe.
Huh. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but malice.
Never attribute to malice that which can be attributed to stupidity, right? And this is an example of the latter.
But then in that case, I can't even say central banking or government.
Well, looks like the Hamilton position.
Administration of the money supply, because then they could just be misled on that too.
Of course.
All right, so then everybody could be misled on everything, and so even Hillary Clinton's a libertarian.
But Hillary Clinton is consciously against the NAP and explicitly.
I'm going to have to think about this. I don't really know what my answer is. What's your answer?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not a libertarian. I'm an anarchist. Tom Woods, thank you so much for joining us today. How can listeners find out more about you? Go to Tom. We'll have links in the show notes page to your Twitter. And are you on Facebook? Your Facebook page and your website. And until then, see you next time.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
That was fun.